Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Wednesday. It's October 29th. Right now, 33 degrees in Park City, 27 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, Cedar Keynes. Good morning.
Happy Wednesday, KPCW listeners. We're looking at lots of sunshine as we go throughout the day with those temperatures warming up, but it's going to be a frigid start out there early in the morning. Highs today, though, should rebound to the upper 50s there in Park City, and we should be in the low 60s in the Heber Valley. As we move into your forecast for your Thursday, look for plenty of sunshine, another frigid start with temperatures in the upper 20s there in the Heber Valley. We'll be into the low 30s in Park City. We'll see those highs a little cooler, actually, as we go into your Thursday afternoon. Highs only in the mid-50s in Park City and highs only around 60 in the Heber Valley. We'll stay that way as we go into your Friday. Halloween is looking clear with lots of sunshine. Temperatures starting off in the 20s in the Heber Valley and into the low 30s in Park City. But Friday afternoon, we should see those highs rebounding into the mid to upper 50s with highs in the upper 50s to low 60s for us in the Heber Valley. As we get into the weekend, expect a few clouds as a disturbance moves by to our north on your Saturday. So we'll call it mostly sunny to partly sunny skies. Temperatures starting off in the upper 20s and low 30s, once again with highs right around 60 degrees in Park City on your Saturday. We'll see those highs in the mid-60s in the Heber Valley. As we move towards your Sunday, look for lots of sunshine out there. Temperatures a little milder. We'll be in the low 60s for highs in Park City. Highs will be in the mid to upper 60s in the Heber Valley. Heading into next week, with high pressure still in charge, we're going to keep it pretty dry. We're also going to keep it pretty sunny out there with those high temperatures in the low 60s for us in Park City for your Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday afternoons. We'll see those high temperatures in the mid to upper 60s for us in the Heber Valley for your Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And as far as those morning low temperatures go, we'll see those numbers right around freezing to kick off the day each morning in the Heber Valley with temperatures right around 40 degrees to start the day in Park City. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Keynes.
KPCW News Time now, 8:09. Good morning. Well, stay tuned. Coming up this morning on the Local News Hour, I'll be talking with the chair of the Ski and Snowboard Archives Board, Barbara Yamada, along with the recipient of this year's Quinney Award, Colin Hilton. The co-author of the production of The Girl in the Yellow Dress, Tal Hughes, has details about another production of this original play. And from the Park City Senior Center, Executive Director Trayson Dixon, along with Board President Liz Novak. Taking a look at some local news now, Park City leaders are close to finalizing the site plan for the next major development in the center of town. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports the public has one more chance to comment before the developer officially applies to build.
Park City Council members appeared surprised at the lack of public comments at their October 23rd meeting with the future developer of Bonanza Park. Mayor Nan Worrell says now is the time for residents to weigh in on the site plan for the five-acre project.
I've been dismayed when some people have mentioned to me they're going to wait until after the election to weigh in on Bonanza Park. And I will just say here, that's too late, my friends. This is when we're talking about it. This council is giving direction to these to the developer here. They need to move forward.
Bonanza Park's site plan refers to the heights of various buildings and where they're located on the five-acre lot at Kearns Boulevard and Bonanza Drive. The land is currently home to a now-closed Maverick gas station and parking lot. The current council says it will talk about the site plan once more on November 6th before taking a vote. Bryn Shore Development will then file an application with the planning department. The project will eventually come back before the council, and there will be more opportunities for public input, but the layout may be locked in. The only public comment October 23rd came from Parkite Deborah Ritfro, who says she attended a Bryn Shore open house earlier in the week.
I want to applaud them because at the very beginning of this, they said they weren't trying to drive a certain response. They were really trying to be open-ended and let people really weigh in and tell what their opinions were.
She offered miscellaneous feedback, such as minding the overhead clearance in the project's underground parking garage. Members of the city council also offered generally positive feedback on the current draft plan after numerous discussions with Bryn Shore this fall. The council remains split on features like a splash pad. If that has to go, the mayor says it should be replaced with another gathering place.
We complain that we're losing our families, we're losing our middle class, so let's do something there. Let's put our money where our mouth is and do something there that matters to families. Those are my comments.
Let's house the families.
That's Councilmember Ed Parisian reiterating his belief that the project is a missed opportunity housing-wise. Brinshore says the draft footprint can fit between 106 and 112 housing units. Around 85 would be reserved for people making from 40 to 80% of Summit County's median income. Parisian wants more.
We get complaints about putting housing all over the place. If there's any place that it belongs, I'm going to keep saying this, this is the place.
He predicts his colleagues will outvote him on the housing issue. The rest of the council has questions on a performing arts space in the center of the property's park area. They want to see comparisons to other theaters at their next meeting. Park City bought the land in 2017. It was envisioned as an arts and culture district and the future home of Kimball Arts Center before the nonprofit announced a move to Kimball Junction. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, the 2025 Ski Affair to benefit the Ski and Snow Sports Archives at the University of Utah's Marriott Library being held tonight. It's a sold-out event, but the CEO of the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation and Park City resident Colin Hilton will be honored. In the studio with details, I have the chair of the event, Barbara Yamada, along with Colin. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning.
So, Barbara, maybe you can tell us just a little bit more about tonight's event. As I mentioned, it's sold out, but you are hoping to raise money for the archives. How much are you hoping to raise?
Well, that amount is never really determined, but whatever we can get would be great.
Okay. So what's in the archives?
We have a lot of photos, books, film. We're also the repository of the 2002 Olympic Games. And so a lot of the ski history in the United States is housed at the University of Utah.
Okay. And so how is the money spent? I mean, you raise it, and what does it go toward?
It goes toward paying students to, monitor those and to file them and archive them. So we have a big collection. It's called Special Collections, and Ski Archives is part of that.
All right. So is anybody invited to come in and see them? Or?
Oh, anyone. All you have to do is make an appointment, and they will pull out whatever you'd like to see. And you could also go through the manuscripts area. We have a great staff up there.
Okay. Again, this is at the Marriott Library in the campus of the University of Utah?
That's correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What floor? Any idea?
It's on the fourth floor.
Okay. And then who is it that decides what stays and what goes? So, I mean, my guess is that you probably see a lot of memorabilia.
Apparently, there is a committee in the archives that goes through the collections, and then they determine where they can be stored and for how long.
All right. So the board will also be honoring Colin Hilton, as I mentioned, with what is known as the Quinney Award. So tell us what this is and why Colin was nominated for it.
Well, Colin was nominated because of his efforts with the Utah Olympic Park, the facilities there, and what's being done with the youth of in the sports in Utah.
Okay. And the Quinney Award refers to what?
It's the Joseph S. Quinney. He was one of the founders of ALTA and one of our contributors.
All right. Well, Colin, tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, before Utah, you worked in soccer and at the Summer Olympics, huh, in Atlanta?
Yes. I'm really thankful for the Ski Archives group with the University of Utah for this recognition. It's really, to me, a recognition of our legacy foundation and the efforts that have been going on from even just the creation of the idea of having a legacy foundation has a great story. It was, you know, early leaders in the late 80s, in the early 90s who thought, if we're going to host the Olympics, let's make sure we have a legacy foundation that takes care of the facilities afterward, especially the hard to keep up ones and the ones that are usually financially challenged. So instead of just planning for a 3-week sporting event, there was a thought to put together a legacy foundation. And I just feel lucky that I happen to be the guy who has been running this for the last 19 years. I've got a terrific staff of people that, quite frankly, we've punched above our weight with as any nonprofit does, with scarce resources and doing a lot. So I'm quite honored and humbled for this recognition.
Okay. But your background is in sport and...
Yes. I grew up in Western New York where, you know, every morning ahead of school, hoping for school closings with the lake effect snow off of Lake Erie. And that happened a lot. And that gave us a lot of opportunity to, you know, play outside, make forts. I grew up, was a ski tech at a ski rental shop just outside of Kissing Bridge, a little hill in Western New York. And I've always loved winter sport, but sport in general, and was a part of an event called the World University Games in 1993 in my hometown of Buffalo, and went to Boston for FIFA World Cup 94, Atlanta for the Summer Games in 96, and just we had a sequence of international sporting events that just gave those of us who were very mobile and hopped from city to city a chance to work on these large mega events. And when the Winter Games team needed some experienced folks, we came out to the mountains, and I have never left since.
Yeah. So you started, you said, you've been with Utah Olympic Legacy for 19 years, so not from the very beginning? Who had that role before you?
John Bennion was my predecessor, and I was actually working here for the city of Park City as their economic development director, and I kept telling the leadership of the Legacy Foundation that, you know, we worked really hard for that legacy fund and you've got the doors open, but not a lot of people are using it. And I guess I kept making those comments enough that they said, why don't you come and right the ship? And it was going well. The doors were open, but I think the biggest influence that I recognized was a need to not just run facilities, but to run the programs in the facilities and hire the coaches, the instructors, and do what we call a living legacy of active uses.
So let's talk a little bit about that legacy fund, because originally, I think after the Olympic Games, it was like $160 million. We paid back the
state $59 million
that voters had approved to build the Olympic facilities, the speed skating oval and all the sliding tracks and all of that. But still out of that, you've got $47 million, I think I read in your program. So you've done pretty well. I mean, you still got a bunch of money.
It has done well. And the nobody knew how long and how much money would be required to run the legacy venues. And those venues, just so the listeners know, is Utah Olympic Park, Soldier Hollow Nordic Center, and the Utah Olympic Oval down in the Salt Lake Valley. And those traditionally are the ones that they don't make money, they don't break even, they have to be subsidized. And, you know, as a nonprofit, we value participation rates more than, you know, making profit some of the other winter facilities do. And so the legacy fund, nobody thought actually would last even 20 years. So the fact that we still have $46 million in the bank, the investment earnings is what allows us to subsidize the facilities and the programs. And while that's been declining, having the next games in 2034 is looking to re-endow that and to finally get us into a financially sustainable model. We're not there yet. And a lot of what we've been trying to do is find dynamic uses of these legacy venues and to have public activities and have them serve as community recreation centers just as much as they are national team training facilities.
So are you anticipating about another $160 million to come into the legacy coffers?
That is the goal. And Fraser Bullock, our executive chair of the organizing committee now for 2034, many years ago when we were in the bid phase of getting the games, asked me, what's it going to take, Colin, for the Legacy Foundation to be able to be financially sustainable? And I did the math, and we are hoping to build that fund to a point where it earns about $10 to $12 million a year in investment earnings. And that would allow us to not only pay for the operating budget subsidy, but also the capital upkeep, of which the state has been currently helping us with.
I was going to say, over the 32 years between the 02 and 34 games, you are making renovations, but none of, I don't think, the facilities have been replaced. That would be next on your docket now.
Well, a little, I would say we've been doing those repairs and upkeep as we go. And when those life cycles of refrigeration plants or roofs of the Oval came due, we were taking care of those. When the cost started to get to be $3 to $4 million a year on capital upkeep, that's when we approached the state in about 2019. And then, and currently they are helping us at the three legacy venues with about $75 million of improvements over a 10-year period.
Okay, those don't have to be paid back though?
No, and because a little bit of that is we've been working with our partner at the University of Utah about looking at the economic impacts that our foundation does and bringing athletes and visitors to the state as a result of having these legacy venues operating. And that direct economic contribution is about $131 million a year.
A busy week for you. In addition to tonight's honor, you've got a board meeting on Thursday, at which time the board is set to adopt the Vision 2035, as well as a 10-year strategic framework. So what do these programs lay out then for you?
Well, as we anticipated getting the award of a Future Games, it was time for our board and our staff to look at what do we want to look like in 2035, and how is that a little bit different than we are operating today? Because I would say for the last 15 years especially, we have been undercapitalized, under-resourced, and we've asked a lot of our staff to do a lot. And that effort, of course, was hoping that we would get an award of a Games. And with this process, we spent a year and a half developing a 10-year strategic plan and what we want to look like. And that obviously has things like we want to be financially sustainable. We don't want to have local or state tax dollars helping us in running these facilities. We want to self-sustain ourselves, and that is probably the primary goal, but we also want to expand our reach as an Olympic and Paralympic Legacy Foundation. We've been very focused just in the three venues of the Heber Valley, the Park City community, and the Kearns west side of Salt Lake. As an entity looking to grow winter sport throughout the state, we hope to expand into other areas of the state.
Okay. Well, and I'm looking at the plan, I was surprised to see just how much money has been spent recently. I mean, $3 million at the UOP, another $15 million out at the Soldier Hollow Nordic Center, another $800,000 at the Utah Olympic Oval. What are some of the other high-cost plans that you've got in store here?
Well, we've actually done most of the big ticket items. We do have a few coming up. The most notable at the Olympic Park starting next summer would be to replace the shading and lighting system of the bobsled track. This is at a point where we have to take the big area lights and put the lights under the hood, if you will, of the sliding track and provide for a little bit better way to protect the sun and the snow from getting into the track. And so that will be probably about a $20 million improvement. And that will be sort of the last big ticket item for that. We will also have to reprofile the ski jumps to get them to current homologation standards.
What does that mean, reprofile?
The landing hills have to have a little bit different shape for safety purposes and a little bit of an increase on the large hill.
Okay, so some bulldozing work here.
Yes, yeah. A little earthwork and yeah. Reprofiling.
Yeah. Now, a hotel and conference center also slated to be built at the UOP there. Do you got your final approvals?
We're working through that right now with Summit County. We are excited about this because this is an effort to not only add additional services for our guests and families coming to the park, but also as a way to generate some income for a facility that currently loses money every year. And so in doing this, we think it's gonna add to the campus of vibrant activity and provide actually if you will, less traffic of people being able to stay and stay overnight while they come for competitions or other things and enjoy the park as an overall destination resort.
So the location for this is you're going to take down the existing day lodge and then kind of build it there right at the foot of the pools. Yeah?
Yes. So we've got a great partner in Utah Development and Construction. Locally, people know Chris Conaby. Chris has got a great track record of doing hotel projects like this. And he is invested, and this company is invested in us trying to have self-sustaining venues and having a hotel and conference center that will wrap around the pool. We're looking at about 120 units, and this will just be spectacular. It is. I'm so excited for this, and it's going to take about a two-year build, which we hope to start in the middle of April next year.
All right, and it sounds like as a result, the pool needs to be closed down. So what does that mean for the athletes?
Yeah, and I think there's a little misunderstanding there. The pool is just going to be shut down for next summer, not for multiple summers. So the training pool will have to close because we're doing a lot of earthwork and foundation work of that hotel right around the pool. And but we will have the airbag and the Nordic Hills and those facilities still open for training.
Okay. And it also sounds like there may be some changes to the governance structure. Tell me what's happening here.
Yeah. You know, we've been operating with powers and purposes as derived in 1995 for our foundation. So as a part of our reimagining what our foundation will look like as we build up to a Next Games, we looked at the structure of what we do. We're a foundation, but we basically self-fund ourselves with the investment earnings of that legacy fund. And our foundation currently acts as both the holder of that legacy fund and the assets, as well as the operator. So we want to create two 501c3s, a separate one that just holds the legacy fund and the assets, and a second one that is the operator of the three venues. And that way, we mitigate the risks associated with potential liability claims and other benefits that allow us to keep a future self-sustaining operation of these facilities.
Okay, so one is the Utah Olympic Legacy Fund. It looked like the other one was for Park City Ski and Snowboard. It was PCSS. What's that stand for?
Park City Ski and Snowboard is currently an LLC underneath the nonprofit of the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, and that will continue to be that case.
Okay. All right. So have we renamed the second?
As a legacy operator, yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Barbara, also wanted just a quick note that another honor tonight will be to Ski Utah.
Ski Utah is celebrating their 50th anniversary. It'll be really fun to have them there.
Okay. So that's just kind of a recognition as opposed to some award?
Well, they do get the History Maker Award for this, yes.
Okay.
And we will also be celebrating the University of Utah ski team's 17th NCAA championship.
Amazing. Okay, anything else you wanted to mention?
I just want a shout out to my staff. You know, the best part of my job has been to develop a team of people. And over the past 19 years, we've developed such a great, awesome team that I'm just so proud. And that, to me, is what the recognition for our foundation for this award. So thank you, Barbara, and thank you, Leslie.
Okay, you bet. Barbara, Colin, thanks so much for your time this
morning.
Thank
you, Leslie.
When Tal Hughes and Ethan Scott were just 17 years old, Timpanogos Valley Theater gave them the opportunity to produce their original play, The Girl in the Yellow Dress. Now, after several rewrites, the play will be produced once again at Timp Valley Theater. In the studio with details, I have both Tal and Ethan. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. We're happy to be here.
Yes.
Thank you.
So Tal, maybe you start and just tell us, what's the genesis of the play, The Girl in the Yellow Dress?
Well, you know, it all started because Ethan and I spent all of our growing up years going to this theater, TVT, Timpanogos Valley Theater, to watch plays and to be in plays. And one day, we went to see a play called Yellow. And as we were sitting there watching with our friends, I remember just having this distinct idea of an idea for a story where a little girl in a yellow dress helps a teenage boy kind of navigate the difficulties of growing up. And immediately after the show ended, I went to Ethan and I told him the idea. And pretty soon we started writing it. And so the genesis of this show is, you can imagine, two teenagers who are getting ready for their ACTs and applying to colleges are also spending every spare minute they have in Ethan's basement writing a story just for fun. And then we tried to pitch it to our community theater, and we said, well, maybe they won't actually let us do it, but they did, and they gave us the time and the space and the resources to do it.
That's awesome. So, I mean, Ethan, how much, you since you had been in plays, you kind of knew what a play looked like in terms of writing it, so you had that much understanding?
Yeah. Tal and I had the privilege to both be in a program called the Ethos Acting Studio in Heber, which was really helpful to us as writers. We learned about how to take apart a script and understand what the basis of a story is. We also have really enjoyed over the years meeting a lot of different people from theater communities in Utah. Obviously, there's a vibrant theater scene throughout the state. Down on the Wasatch Front, we have a lot of friends who are writers and directors and community leaders in the theater out there, who would also give us feedback and tell us, oh, here's how the story needs to change. Here, you need to speed it up here. You need to focus on these things. And so, you know, there were a lot of different members of the community, both in Heber and in the Valley and in the entire state, who we kind of were able to use resources from.
Awesome. So how different is the play today from what it was back in, 2022?
Yeah, what I like to tell people is, if anything's changed, it's mostly just order of events and some clarity. It's in a lot of ways the same main story. It's just been cleaned. There are some changes in story. There are changes in relationship, right? I think our biggest changes were, you know, these characters who used to be friends in an old draft, they now don't know each other. Or these, this one character whose story originally ended this way, their ending now changes a little bit. So a lot more clear, simple, but if you saw the show before and you're coming back, don't expect something completely new. It's still the same key story.
And I was going to ask, I mean, why did you want to do a redo of the play rather than trying something new?
Well, when we did The Girl in the Yellow Dress the first time, we felt like it was something that we really learned a lot from. We learned from it, and our cast taught us things, and then when our community came to see it, they brought a lot of things to us after they'd seen the show of what they loved and what they'd found interesting. And we found that a lot of people didn't even hear about it in time to come see the show. So we really wanted to give another chance to take in all the input we got and all the things that we had learned from our cast members and our community, and then bring the show back and say, okay, now that people have heard of it, we're going to do it another time so that the people can hear and see the show.
Yeah. Awesome. Are any of the original actors involved in today's production?
So the boy who played our main actor last time, his name is Roy Buttermore. He is now the assistant director in the show, and he's having a great time. I think that's our only returning actor this time around.
Yeah. We also have an incredible live soundtrack for the show, which is an original soundtrack created by one of our idols from the theater,
yeah,
whose name is Caleb Wall. He's an incredible musician, and he was there for the first production. He'll also be returning, yeah, for this production to do music again.
Oh, another exciting.
I was going to say new music then? Or was it?
A lot of the same soundtrack with some changes.
Yeah. The other thing I almost forgot to mention, our costumer from last year is Kristen Hughes. She's my mother and also the director of our acting studio. And this year she is costuming again, but she's also in the cast.
Nice. So are you co-directors or do you have somebody else directing the play?
Right. So when we did the play the first time, we were co-directors. This time, you know, things have got more complicated because Ethan went and grew up on us and he went to Stanford University.
That's true.
And so, you know, writing the play from different states has been difficult, and I went on an LDS mission to Brazil, so we, you know, the play was on the back burner for a long time. So this time around, as Ethan comes home, I'm taking the director role, which is sort of just like the big vision. Ethan is the stage manager, which is the making sure things actually happen. And but we've still been collaborating with the writing of the play over the months and years.
All right. Yeah. So what did you study at university?
Oh, it's been planetary science so far. I'm not finished yet, but that's probably what it'll turn into.
Okay, so kind of broken away from the theater and the writing?
Yeah, there's not a lot of overlap between script writing and planetary science, but there are a few key golden ones.
And how about you, Tal?
I go to BYU, and I'm currently studying interdisciplinary humanities, and everyone always says, well, what is that? It's just it's history and societies and philosophy and literature all in one.
All right.
Throw it all into one.
So are you working on anything new, or you just kind of wanted to finish this one? And
yeah, I don't know if Ethan is working on anything in his square, in his corner. I feel like I'm always got about 10 projects going that aren't going very quickly. And then I can kind of dedicate my time to one of them at a time. So for the last while, that's been The Girl in the Yellow Dress.
I've been working on a play since The Girl in the Yellow Dress, but it is a long time coming. I don't know if it'll be finished for another couple of years at least, but it's called Cargo Cult.
Say that again?
Cargo Cult, which is kind of an anthropological concept that some old anthropologists came up with about an island in Micronesia. So that's kind of what the play is about.
Okay. Well, I think of just how welcoming of Timpanogos Valley Theater to give you kids really an opportunity to do this. Did you have to repitch this, and what was their response?
We did. Oh, it was the sweetest thing, actually. When I came in to pitch this play the second time, I came into their meeting, and I said, I have a play I'd love to direct. And before I said anything, one of the members of the board said, yes, whatever it is, you absolutely can. I said, well, you better hope I don't say something crazy. So much support, even more than we had the last time. It's been fantastic.
That's great. Okay, so tell us when and where people can see The Girl in the Yellow Dress.
Yeah, so performances will be November 7th to November 15th. We perform on Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays, and Saturdays.
And we do have some matinee performances as well.
We do.
On the Saturdays.
On the Saturdays. And then if you want to get tickets, you can go to timpvalleytheater.com.
Okay, tickets are how much? Any idea?
Oh, last time I checked, you remember, Ethan?
It's in the neighborhood of $10.
Yeah,
I'm not sure exactly.
Very reasonable.
Yeah. Yeah, we like to keep it accessible and family-friendly and, you know, well, inviting people to come.
Okay, so you're doing this while school is in session?
That's right. Tal's had some troubles with that the last little bit.
I'm going to class after this. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
he's really been, we've all seen him working really hard to cram in as much as he can. I mean, he just painted the backdrop last night and then ran off down to get some homework done and prep for his tests this week. And he's a really hard worker, so we've all been admiring that about him.
Yeah. And then for you, you said you're not finished with school yet?
That's right. I'm on a semester of leave at the moment, but I'll be going back soon.
Yeah. Okay. All right, guys. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Well, I guess we want to express our gratitude to KPCW as well. So many people supporting us in just something that we love to do.
All right. Well, congratulations and hope it goes really well. Thanks
Thank
for coming
you.
In.
Thank you so
Appreciate
much.
Your time. That's Tal Hughes and Ethan Scott, the co-writers of the original play, The Girl in the Yellow Dress. You can see that at Timpanogos Valley Theater, November 7th through the 15th. Last week, leaders from the Park City Senior Center presented their annual report to the Park City Council, one of the government organizations that funds the center. In the studio with details, I have Tracy Dixon, the executive director, along with Liz Novak, the board's president. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Leslie.
So the annual report was a work session item on the council agenda. You started by outlining membership growth. In the last 5 years, the center's grown from 70 members to 657, and in the last 3 years alone, almost 300 new members. So what do you attribute that growth to?
Well, it is a bit overwhelming, I will say that, and we are nearing the 700 mark pretty quickly here. I believe that we, because of the population of our seniors increasing year to year within Park City municipal area as well as Summit County, I think if there's a high degree of interest in our seniors in the community connecting with other seniors. And I think the fact that we offer so many programs, so many services, and lunch Monday through Thursday at Senior Center here on Woodside, I think there's just, given the population growth in this particular demographic, and the fact that we offer some really cool things for seniors to connect to is one of the reasons that we are seeing such tremendous growth.
So word of mouth, you think? I mean, just seniors telling their friends?
That's definitely a major factor. Every day I'm hearing from folks that,
you know, have heard just word on the street about our programs, about our offerings. So definitely the word is spreading throughout the community.
And yeah. I also think there's quite a bit of marketing that goes on. Of course, Leslie, the opportunity to interview with you and talk a little bit about what's happening at the center and let the community know. I think the website is very robust. Trayson puts out a newsletter twice a month. So I just think the communication also in terms of what we have to market is really making a tremendous difference as well.
Yeah. So are you required to do this type of annual reporting?
We're not, I would say we're not, quote, required, but the memorandum of understanding between the county and the city provides an opportunity for the senior center to provide the annual report, and we're happy to do it. One of the things that we like to talk about is the progress that we're making and make sure that those folks who are supporting the senior center, our members, Park City Municipal and Summit County, is well aware that the resources that they're providing really is making a difference in the community.
Yeah. So you showed that more than half of the members come from within the city limits, the other half from the Snyderville Basin, but you're also seeing lots of others come from the county, residents who are closer to the Camas and Colville Senior Center. So any idea why that is?
I think it's because of what we're offering.
Absolutely.
You know, as I indicated earlier, we're open Monday through Thursday, whereas the Colville and Camas Senior Centers are only open 2 days a week. So I think that coupled with the fact that we're offering lunch 3 days a week.
Mm-hmm. And our program offerings are far more robust than Colville and Camas. Simply put, we're bursting at the seams with activities, and we're going to continue to keep it that way.
Yeah. So how do they get to Park City? Are they driving themselves?
Some of them carpool. There is the transit system that they're connecting with. And then just individually coming into town.
Yeah. Now, so do the other centers have more room than Park City? I mean, could you move some of those activities to the other centers, or it's you're pretty territorial?
Well, I don't know that our members would, you know, living in this particular area, would be willing to drive to Camas and or Colville. So I think that's part of the issue. And I think their facilities are also small. Colville has a very similar building or facility as we do. They have a former train depot, if you will, in Colville. So they're limited in space. And of course, they're only open again 2 days a week. Camas is a little larger facility that Summit County built for them a few years back.
Mm-hmm. And we're very much trying to build a one-stop shop for seniors within Park City and the surrounding area. So, you know, obviously being able to serve our population means being able to serve them in their community.
Okay. So do you ever have to exclude members from either the programs or the meals because you just don't have room for them?
Not at this particular time. I know some of the programs, and Tracy can probably speak to this a little better, but some of the programs do have a limit in terms of how many participants can partake.
Yes. One instance that has happened recently is we've begun a line dancing program. If anybody who has been at our center knows that we have extremely limited space. So essentially we're limited to about 15 individuals who can participate in that given activity. And then for lunch as well, you know, we're quickly approaching that limit where we can fit all of the individuals who want to participate in our lunch program in our building. The space is severely lacking.
Yeah, I think I read you can seat about 50 people for lunch?
Comfortably about 56. If needed, we can add additional tables in our exercise room, but obviously that's not ideal.
Yeah, they're not together then. Mm-hmm. Again, you haven't had to turn anybody away at this point, but that's you're pretty much at your max, it sounds like.
Yeah, we're quickly approaching that limit, absolutely.
Okay, and then the number of activities were very impressive. I mean, in 2022, 3 years ago, you had about 30. You're up to like 191 this year. Is that individual programs, or is that how do you count activities?
Yes, that is individual, unique programs that we are offering, which includes all of our presentations as well as performances that are held at the center. But yes, over the past 9 months, 191 individual programs.
Yeah, so I mean, line dancing, that's one program, or that is that would 10 programs because you do it every month?
That would constitute one program, yes. Again, that's factoring in one-off programs, including bus trips and other outings.
Okay. Let's see. It takes a lot of support from both Park City and Summit County, which helps provide maintenance for snow removal. The activities need to be subsidized, pays for the cooks, the cleaning, covers utilities. And I guess how much more do you need from the government to keep this going?
Well, I think in the areas of personnel and facility, those are our two main challenges right now. And I will say this, Leslie, our model in terms of supporting the Park City Senior Center is very different than any other senior center in the state of Utah and throughout the country. Most senior centers are subsidized, you will, or supported by a government agency, whether it be a city, a municipality, or a county office. For example, Wasatch County supports in total the Heber Senior Center. That's personnel, that's meals, that's the facility, everything. So I think part of our challenge is, on the one hand, it's a unique model to have a three-legged stool approach, meaning Park City, the nonprofit, Park City Municipal, and also Summit County. But it does create some challenges because we're all looking at each other saying, who's going to generate the resources to support the senior center? Right now, if the nonprofit went away, I'm not so sure that the senior center would continue in its current state. So we're looking at Summit County, which they do provide, as you indicated, meals and some personnel to support those meals, an administrative assistant. And then Park City Municipal, thankfully, provided a nonprofit grant so that we could hire an executive director. So it's everybody working together as a team, but everybody's got to do the heavy lifting. And I think that's our challenge, because to answer your question directly, it's personnel and it's facility.
Yeah. So what is the latest on the senior center?
Park City Council did approve a design team agreement with Sprano and Mooney at $122,000. So there's some skin in the game, if you will. And the design team is working with representatives in the community as well as senior center representatives. Craig Weekly and Linda McReynolds works with the design team. So where we are right now is we're looking at what does just the site look like. We're not talking about the design yet. We don't even know where the front door is going to be. But it's basically where the facility would sit and the parking issue. There is a work session scheduled with Park City Council November 6th to flesh out what that looks like. So some designs with regard, again, site placement and parking will go to City Council next week.
Okay.
So we're making progress. There's no shovel in the ground yet, but we are making progress.
And the dream, I guess, still this 15,000 square foot, it would be two stories or single level?
I don't even think they're there yet. I think the square footage, though, I think you're spot on with that. We're looking at minimum 15,000, but in terms of, again, what does the design of the building look like? I think it's a little premature.
All right. And then the meals, I think you're hoping to get Monday through Friday eventually?
Thursday.
Just Monday through Thursday?
Right. Currently, it's 3 days a week, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday. And the budget committee, from what I understand, the Summit County Budget Committee will go to council recommending a fourth meal at the Park City Senior Center. So we'll hear more hopefully tonight. They have their council meeting tonight. So we're starting, or I shouldn't say we, Summit County is in the process of starting their budget happenings.
Yeah, so have you made a request?
Oh, absolutely.
And how?
We would like the additional fourth meal. We would like more personnel support. We would like Summit County to put funds aside to help us with the capital outlay needs of the new senior center. So we've made our request.
Okay.
We'll see how it plays out.
And what is that kind of total? I mean, how much when you add all that up?
Well, we're asking Summit County to, over the next couple of years, put money aside. So we were looking at $250,000 a year for personnel, and then about $750,000 for capital outlay.
Okay. And what sort of response did the city council have after your presentation?
Well, I thought they were quite pleased. We felt very good about the presentation, and I think council extended their gratitude. I think that they really appreciated the progress that we have made at the Senior Center. And in fact, there was discussion about how can the Park City Municipal support even more so the personnel end. So there was discussion from council about operationalizing the resources that we would need to continue to have an executive director. So we felt very, very positive about the outcome. And of course, thanks to the council, we're looking at a new senior center.
Yeah. Are you full-time, Tracy, at this point?
Currently, I'm working 30 hours a week.
Okay.
We need him more.
Yes, absolutely. needless to say, 30 hours a week is not enough.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, just thank you for the opportunity. And if I may, I'd like to give a shout-out to Cheryl Shosnick, who's our president of Vice. I'm sorry, her vice president. It's her birthday today, so happy birthday, Cheryl.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you, Leslie.
Trayson Dixon and Liz Novak with the Park City Senior Center.